I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Everybody, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Claudia Wu.
And I'm Carrie Diamond.
And we're the founders of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food.
First, a shout out to our sponsors. Thank you to Ecole Chocolat, the online school for those looking to become chocolate makers or chocolate experts. The Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts in Manhattan, where you can start your journey to becoming a natural food chef. Prince Street, the new fresh podcast with a culinary heart from Dean and DeLuca. And Baldor. Baldor Specialty Foods curates and delivers the best and freshest food in the world to the restaurant and hospitality industries. Radio Cherry Bomb is part of the not-for-profit Heritage Radio Network, so we rely on our sponsors to get the lights on. Be sure to check out our sponsors' websites and support them however you can. So we're very excited about today's first guest. Today, we welcome back one of our favorite guests, the smart, funny, and fabulous Sarah Moulton. She's been teaching America how to cook for decades, whether through her 15-year run on Good Morning America, her 20 years helming the gourmet magazine Test Kitchen, or her years as one of the Food Network's earliest stars. This native New Yorker also spent years working with Julia Child. Then in 1982, Moulton co-founded the New York Women's Culinary Alliance. We're definitely going to talk about that. Her latest book is Sarah Moulton's Home Cooking 101, How to Make Everything Taste Better. We're very pleased to welcome Sarah Moulton back to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Well, thank you, Carrie and Claudia, for having me back.
We're really excited you're here. You were so funny last time you were here. We had no idea how funny you are.
Oh, dear, I better not tell the same jokes.
We'll make sure you don't. In fact, to make sure we didn't talk about the same things, I was deeply engrossed in every article written about you that I could find on the internet, and I actually missed my subway stop. So I had to, like, do this thing on the F and the G and figure out how to transfer again. But we made it in time, and here we are today. So what have you been up to in the year since we saw you last?
Well, finishing this book. You know, it was due a year ago March and came out, a year ago March. And, you know, writing any book is like giving birth, whether it's a cookbook or a regular book. My mom was a writer, too, and she felt the same way. But this book, triplets. Oh, my God. I didn't even leave the house the last 2 weeks. The only reason I left the house... It's a long story, but we live in a co-op, and the elevator broke down, and my husband helped somebody in the building try to get their suitcase stuck in the elevator and ended up opening the elevator on his finger. We went to the emergency room. It was the Friday before the Monday the book was due, and I had not left the house. And at that point, I knew, we were in the ambulance heading to the emergency ward. You know, I'm not going to hand it in on time. I have to. But I was really, it's a happy ending. His finger's fine. It was sort of fun because the surgeon, we had to get a hand surgeon, was a woman who came in a silk pantsuit. You know, she was really, and she took all her tools out of her pocketbook. She'd come from dinner, and she just elegantly sewed him up and everything. And then we walked back. We lived down in Chelsea, and it was what's across from St. Vincent's, which has now been turned into those condos. And I thought to myself, I'm so glad to be out. But anyway, it was a really intense book. I think it's my best book. I like my books. I think they're nice, you know, and they help people get dinner on the table during the work week. But this is really a manual for home cooks.
What made it so difficult? Because this is your fourth book.
Yes.
Congratulations. I thought you had done so many more, but...
Yeah, I figured you had like 20 books.
I don't have a team. You know, and I don't have a repertoire. You know, it's me, and me. I mean, this last book, I want to say, oh, by the way, I have to correct just one thing you said about me.
Oh, yeah, I meant to ask because I got all that correct.
Because I don't want to piss anybody off. I was not head of the test kitchen. I worked in the test kitchen for 4 years, and then I became chef of the executive dining room.
Ah, okay.
But it was all invaluable. I loved being there. But I was the executive chef, but that meant I was head of the executive dining room. But at any rate, now I've forgotten completely what I was talking about.
What made this book so hard?
Okay, so hard. Well,
triplets.
I had a wonderful partner for my prior three books, Joanne Lamb Hayes, and I couldn't afford to hire her this time. And what she did on the other books, all the recipes for all my books have been tested in my house with my testing team, which is my family. But, and they're, it's gotten to the point where I can't make a normal meal without them critiquing it. I'm like, no, I don't want to know that it needs lemon or I needed to reduce it more. Or, you know, I need to point up the chilies or whatever, you know. But anyway, I couldn't afford to hire Joe, you know, since Gourmet tanked in 2009. I love the freelance world, but it's been a little bit financially interesting. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't hire her, so I had to do it all myself. However, I did hire two wonderful I did not pay them. I brought on board two wonderful interns from ICC, the International Culinary Center, and they were both stellar, and they both have a recipe in the book. And so each one came and worked with me for 6 months. And so that's how I got it done. But a huge part of doing a cookbook is the writing. And the writing of the recipe takes a lot of time. And then, you know, you do it and you have to update it. And then you do it again and you have to update it. And so, and there was a lot of writing beside. This is a very dense book. I hate to say it's a textbook because then everybody's eyes glaze over, their head hits the desk. But it's not boring. Let's put it that way.
It's however, a sexy textbook.
Yeah,
however,
great.
Thank you. Sexy textbook.
No, it's making me
Carrie,
hungry.
I'm going to use that. Thank you very much. There's 150 recipes, over 200 photos. Oxmoor did a really good job with the photography, and I've never gotten so much attention on any book I've done. So I'm very pleased with the end result, but it was hell.
Yeah.
The good news is my husband happens to be a writer, so I write all the their head notes, although they're in sidebars, and I write all the other material, and then he translates in English, and then I tell him to put my voice back in, and he does, and then we're done. But it was intense.
The worst part's the proofreading.
Oh, and that went on the second year. So I handed it in March whatever of last year, and then the proofreading, and also we did a lot of the how-to photography. I went to Birmingham, Alabama to shoot that, which is where,
to the test kitchens down there?
Yes. So I went down to do that. So that was the second year. But the proofing, and they allowed me to be involved with all of it.
Do you like being so hands-on?
I do.
Are you a bit of a control freak?
No, not at all. But I had the time, and I just figured this is such a big book, I really want it to be done right. So
it's very international.
I think you have to be. I mean, particularly us here in New York City, but even across the country, the exciting thing for us all is we have so many more toys to play with. So many more ingredients that you don't just have to order online. You can find them at the supermarket. I mean, my parents have a farmhouse in northeastern Massachusetts. We buy our groceries in New Hampshire, and I'm like, there's sriracha, you know, the one from Los Angeles. I mean, via, you know, Indonesia. But at any rate.
It's incredible what you can find today.
Yeah. So, and you have to be international. I mean, part of getting dinner on the table every night is it gets really boring. So it's really nice when you can find new ingredients and go, tonight is Spanish, tomorrow is Thai, you know, the next day is, I don't know, American, you know, Southern. So it's you have to mix it up, otherwise you just want to kill yourself.
Now, you have two children.
I do.
Are they...
Grown up? Very much so, yes.
And what were they like as children when it came to eating?
It's funny because now they eat everything, just about. Ruthie's still not eating a lot of fish. But Sammy was the meat guy and Ruthie was the vegetable girl. And now Ruthie is the meat girl and Sammy eats much more, although he's still a carb guy. But, you know, I did not have children who loved escargot and foie gras. You know, they were picky. And so I just made sure they had lots of choices. But now, the best thing that we ever did, and nobody can really afford to do this, but when they were 14 and 10, my parents, or maybe it was 12 and 8, I think, my parents took us to Paris for spring break. We ate nowhere special for them, and we ate at one fancy restaurant, and the rest were all bistros. And we didn't necessarily plan it. I did a little homework, but other than that, we just walk in anywhere. The kids came back eating differently. It was fantastic. So I'd say that was really a turning point. Not everybody can go to Paris for spring break and have to, you know, introduce their children to, you know, lamb and lobster bisque and, you know, all these exciting things.
It's amazing what kids eat today, though. I mean, my nephews eat sushi, you know, they're under the age of 10, some of them.
It's great. I mean, again, we have so many more options.
I think I was like 23 maybe before I ate sushi.
Well, I didn't even like fish till I was 35. Of course, I'm only 36, but yeah.
Now, did I get right that you are a native New Yorker?
Yes, I was born in New York Hospital. Very proud of that.
So I don't know why, but I always felt like you were a Midwesterner. That's a compliment.
No. I see it as a complete compliment. I went to the University of Michigan. So if I have any accent, it's a Michigan accent. And I married a nice guy from Detroit. Although some people would say he's not so nice. Well, he's sort of naughty. But yeah, I love Midwesterners. I mean, I grew up in New York in the 50s, 60s, and you know, it was really like that was midnight cowboy time here. You know, Times Square was just...
It was rough.
I remember one time coming back from college, or for some reason I was near the Port Authority. I was wearing overalls and a backpack and blah, blah, blah. And a policeman came up to me and said, "You cannot be here. This is not safe for you." That's what New York was like. And we were just used to it. We understood there were certain times you didn't go out, and that when you walked around the city, even after dark, even if it wasn't that late, you walked in the middle of the street. You didn't walk on the sidewalks. So you can imagine I never made eye contact with anybody in New York City. And then I go to visit the University of Michigan. I had a boyfriend there at the time, not the guy I married. But so I went up to visit him, and I was shocked. People looked you in the eye, and they smiled, and they were nice, and they said please and thank you. And oh, I love Midwesterners to this day.
And I read that you majored in the history of ideas. The history of ideas, right. You have to explain how that's a major.
Well, I went to this hippy-dippy part of the University of Michigan. It was the University of Michigan, but they had no grades, just evaluations. It was this little, like, dorm, you know, for alternative arts or whatever. And I took ridiculous classes like Comparative Revolutions of Russia and China and Astrophysics and what we lovingly refer to as Boys and Girls in Books, which was Men and Women in Literature. And I just loved it, and that was what History of Ideas meant, was anything, really. But the one thing we had to do, interestingly enough, because it was undergraduate, was write a thesis. So I wrote my thesis on Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse. I loved Virginia Woolf. I felt like she really understood women. But at any rate, so yeah, that was my crazy, meant nothing. I figure everybody goes to college for one of two reasons, and this is going to sound very privileged, because certainly it costs money. One is to figure out your career, and the other one is to grow up. And I would say I did the latter.
Women used to go to meet husbands, so at least we're making progress on that front.
Right, yeah. Right. True that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you make the leap from the history of ideas to a career in food?
Oh, geez, I didn't tell you that story. when I went to school, to the University of Michigan, I pursued becoming a doctor, a lawyer, a biological medical illustrator, and a teacher. And I didn't really pursue any of them. And so it's a year after I should have graduated. I just finished my thesis, and I'm working in a bar. And the whole time I was at Michigan, I had jobs in restaurants. So I'd been a waitress at an all-night diner. I had to wear this day-glow orange uniform, plastic, with white nurse's shoes. I cooked for a professor and his wife. And then I had this job, finally, slinging burgers in a bar. But there was a little more creativity to it. It was a wonderful restaurant called the Del Rio. To this day, I just have such nostalgia about that place. It's no longer, alas. It closed in the early 2000s. But at any rate, I'm living with my boyfriend, and I'm working 3 days a week, making $60, which is plenty of money back then to pay the rent or whatever. Maybe I was getting some help from the rents. You never know. But my mother is horrified. And so she wrote to Craig Claiborne and Julia Child. Now, not everybody knows who Craig Claiborne was. In New York, a lot of people do. He was the food editor of the New York Times, and he wrote the New York Times cookbook, which was a great book. And a lot of chefs, I'm sure you've talked to, used that book when they were growing up, because it was all the international articles from the New York Times. So we used to throw dinner parties when I was in high school. My mom, we'd cook from that book when she'd started traveling to Europe. So we'd make paella or, you know, spanakopita, and that's where you found the recipes. And we were in New York, so we could do it. So anyway, my mom wrote to Craig Claiborne and Julia Child and didn't tell me, and said, if my daughter wants to become a chef, what should she do? So Julia didn't write her back, probably didn't get the letter, because Julia always wrote everybody back. I knew that later on because I was lucky enough to work with her. But Craig did, and he said, if your daughter wants to become a chef, she should go to cooking school. She should either go to the hotel school in Lausanne, which is where he went, or she should go to the CIA. And I didn't want to go to Lausanne. It was too far away. And I thought, well, I'll apply to CIA, but they won't accept me because I don't know how to use a chef's knife. You know, I'm, you know, rookie. They did. I was like, oh, shit. So I went to the boyfriend who I was living with, and I said, you don't want me to do this, do you? And he said, yeah, actually, I do. I'd like to see other women.
Oh,
so that shot me out of there like a cannon. And so I went to the Culinary Institute, and the day I set foot in door, I was like, why did I wait? It was so exciting.
And you must have been one of the only women.
It was 6-to-1 men to women. It's not, you know, but it was pretty awful. It's better, much better now. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's best, but it's much better. Because back then, the European chefs were beginning to turn, they were all the teachers. So they were German, they were Austrian, they were French. And, you know, the total attitude. So I graduated in 77, started in 75, was women don't belong in the kitchen. You know, all those stupid cliches. Can't stand the pressure, can't stand the heat, can't lift the pans, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, that was catnip to me. I was like, well, I am going to show you guys. But I think that changed. It's just like Andre Saltner, who I now adore. Well, he is a great chef, and he had a great restaurant, but he didn't want to hire women.
Yeah, I read you couldn't get a job in any New York kitchen.
No. No, not just me, anybody at that point. And now he really appreciates women. I think that's changed at the CIA with the European chefs. There's now a lot of American chefs there teaching, but once you see a woman in action in the kitchen and how dedicated she is and how serious she is, it sort of turns you around. But because they'd never seen them, because they'd never given them an opportunity, they had no idea. So it was pretty bad, and the students were like that, too. They were mostly men. They were mostly back then. So I was 23. They were 18, and they'd already, most of them were men and had already worked in restaurants and, you know, had the same attitude, you know, about what are you doing here. So it was rough, but I loved it anyway. I didn't care. It was so exciting. So exciting.
And you didn't end up working in a kitchen, though. You weren't like...
Oh, I did.
Oh, you did?
For 7 years.
Oh, right, in New York.
No, not just... What happened was my dad was sort of horrified. So my mom's the one who got me to do what I should have done. And then my dad is sort of horrified that I don't have a plan. You know, my dad worked for... he did Truss Wilson Estates at one company for like... you know, a zillion years. And so I started in restaurants, and I changed after 9 months. And then I went to another one for a year. And then I went to another one for a year. And he's like, what? But it really is true that women in many professions, but particularly in the food world, don't have a plan. It's sort of hard to have a plan, too, because there's nothing you can count on anymore. But no, I worked in restaurants for 7 years. And my original idea, because I didn't think beyond my original idea, was I wanted to be chef of a great little restaurant. So I worked in Boston for 4 years. 4 years, maybe five. And then I finished up in New York. And so I was a sous chef, and then I was a chef, and then I was another chef. And then I came to New York, and I wanted to get a job in one of these restaurants, but nobody would hire me because I wanted to learn from a great master. And I did interview with Andre Saltner, and he was very charming, but he didn't say, no, I don't want to hire a woman. But I finally got a job with a woman named Sally Dar at a restaurant called La Tulipe, which had 3 stars from the New York Times, a wonderful restaurant on 13th Street. And I was hired as the chef tournant, which is, you know, the substitute cook. So I did everybody's job. And it was fantastic because she was not trained, but probably I learned more from her than anybody else except for Julia Child. She was amazing. And she's still alive. She's 91. But she also taught me everything I know about pastry, which would have been nothing because I didn't really care. But I really learned a lot from her. So that was my last job. And then I was like, oh, darn, I forgot to have kids. You know, I'm of an age where you have to really start thinking about it. And so I left restaurants to do that.
So I'm guessing all of that experience led to the founding of the New York Women's Culinary Alliance.
Yes. I mean, what happened was when I was in Boston, I was lucky enough to work with Julia Child on her show, Julia Child and More Company. And then she sort of, you know, she had an entourage of young people she'd hang out with. She couldn't have kids, but she had plenty of kids, you know, that she sort of adopted us. And we would do dinner parties at her house and hang out. And we sort of noticed, I don't know why, in Boston, because, well, it was a problem there, too. The best restaurants were run by men. That men had organizations, had fraternities, had clubs, but women didn't. So a bunch of us got together and formed the Boston Women's Culinary Guild with Julia. And so when I moved to New York and I was having a hard time getting a job, I thought, wow, you know, we got to do this here in New York City. There was Les Dames des Cafés, and there still is Les Dames des Cafés. And Les Dames des Cafés has had babies all over the place, and that's great. But that also is an organization that you can only get into after you're accomplished. It's not for young people. I don't mean young people, for novices, you know, or people who are just getting into the industry. And so, at any rate, I got together with a bunch of people from Gourmet Magazine because I met them, the La Tulipe, where I worked, the chef de cuisine when I started was Guy Rouge, and he was married to Mariah Rouge, a nice gal from the South. I mean, obviously, he was French, but she was this nice Southern gal, and she worked at Gourmet Magazine. You know, I'm one of those classic people. I've always been in the right place at the right time, meeting the right people. So that's also how I ended up with a job at Gourmet for 25 years. But Mariah and I just decided, let's form this group. And so with a bunch, hardcore bunch of people from Gourmet Magazine, we did. And that started in 82 and still going strong. But what's different with the Alliance, and we're only a one-off, I think for a short while there was a Philadelphia group that did it too, or formed an alliance too. What's different about us is we'll take anybody straight out of cooking school as long as you work full-time in the industry, which means 35 hours a week. And we say 35 hours, which seems like peanuts, but when you do freelance work, it's not. You know, it averages out. And we do require that you be active. But it's all about education and networking. Les Dames does a lot of fundraising and helping young women get scholarships. So it's a different kind of organization. But it's a great group. Yeah, I really love it.
You know, we talk a lot at Cherry Bomb about women finding their own path in the industry. You know, and being the executive chef, chef owner, it's not for everybody. You know, one of the main reasons you brought up, when you want kids working every night, every holiday,
80 hours a week, forget about it.
In a restaurant, there is nothing attractive about that. And you really were one of the first to sort of carve your own path in this industry.
Well, again, I got really lucky. I mean, really. I mean, not everybody has that opportunity. You know, I knew people at Gourmet. Somebody had just left. I applied for the job. The woman who was in charge knew I'd worked for Sally Dar and for Julia Child, Jane Montant. And actually, she didn't like either one of them. But so it was sort of like perverse. So she wanted, I don't know why, so she hired me. So that was really lucky. But yeah, things go away and other things come, you know, because of Julia. A lot was because of Julia. Not everybody has an angel like that. But because of Julia, I had all these introductions in New York, including Sally Dar. So I got a job in a restaurant. Because of Julia, I started working at Good Morning America. She was working at Good Morning America. And because I worked at Good Morning America, behind the scenes, I did all the prep for all the chefs for 10 years. When the Food Network started, they reached out to me because they thought I should run the kitchen of the Food Network. And I said, nah, that's too risky. That network won't last. I didn't want to leave Gourmet because I had benefits and all that stuff. You know, I had a family. I didn't want to get into that kind of trouble. But so one thing led to another. You know, it's just I've been so lucky.
So tell us about Gourmet. I don't know how tired you are of the, oh, we're so sad Gourmet went away. It was such a beautiful magazine. Are you tired of talking about Gourmet?
No. It's so sad and it's so wrong. But it's just, it's what's going on these days. You know, magazines are crashing and burning, and so are newspapers.
Where were you when they announced Gourmet was folding?
I was at the farmer's market shooting for my last book. And I got a phone call from my sous chef in tears. And she said, you're not going to believe this, they're shutting the magazine. That was on a Monday. We had to be out Tuesday.
Wow.
By the end of the day. I don't blame Condé Nast for that. I think that's a good idea. Just get everybody out quick, you know, before things. And it was a perfect storm. I mean, probably more than you ever want to know, because I, at that point, as chef of the executive dining room, we entertained clients who were advertisers for the magazine. So it was my job to make the magazine come alive. It was like having a little excellent restaurant. We only had 16 seats and no food cost. It was a wonderful job.
Like a dream.
But I, because I was on the advertising side, I knew what was going on. Because after 2008, advertisers would not even answer the phone. You could not get anybody to come in and advertise. And not only that, we'd gone through several publishers, and we didn't have a sales staff, and just it was really a perfect storm. And at the end of the day, here's what happened, because I actually went back, here's a little secret, to talk to Tom, I think his name is Tom Wallace. Mm-hmm. The guy who's in charge of, you know.
Tom Wallace, yep.
Yeah. And about, I actually applied for the job at Bon Appetit as editor-in-chief. I know nothing about it, but a friend of mine, Kent Minifee, who is in charge of the kitchen at Gourmet, said, you should do it, you should do it. I'll come on and I'll run the kitchen and you can be the editor-in-chief. And so I was like, what the hell? You know, I've got nothing to lose. You know, I've got no job. So I went in and Tom sort of explained to me what happened, which was that when they took, Condé Nast bought Gourmet, and then however many years later, they bought Bon Appetit. Bon Appetit always had a larger subscription base than Gourmet, but they didn't have the same demographic of high, you know, high earning population. And that's what Condé Nast wanted, and that's what Gourmet always had. But slowly, Bon Appetit ended up with the same demographic as Gourmet. It got more and more and more luxury. So at the end of the day, they have a larger subscription base. They have the luxury demographic. Gourmet has a smaller subscription base. Condé Nast just had to choose.
Ugh.
And other things, like what I understand is also Condé Nast had put a lot of money into a financial magazine called Portfolio, which was the wrong time to do it.
Right.
I mean, who knew what was coming?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Who knew what was coming? So it was a perfect storm.
But Gourmet was such a beautiful magazine.
Wasn't it?
And I mean, the Bon Appetit we're talking about is a very different beast from Adam Rappaport's Bon Appetit today. But it was just, there was no competition back
no.
then. I mean, people save those Gourmets.
Oh, I have them.
I go to people's homes and they still have their old Gourmets. I've never gone anywhere and seen an old copy of Bon Appetit.
Well,
I have to be honest.
Yeah, you got a point there. And I would say also that, you know, I started in the test kitchen for the first 4 years at Gourmet. I was in the test kitchen. I think we had the best test kitchen in the end. It was so exciting because my job was to make the magazine come alive. And, you know, again, how we all get bored making the same recipes. But we had to keep doing new things in the dining room from the current issue. And I just kept learning so much from the women in there. And they all had different specialties. Women and there was one man. I mean, but they were all so talented. So
I had said that I was spending all this time on the subway reading about you. And I was determined to find one thing about you I didn't know. Because I know a fair amount about you now at this point. And you have a Beastie Boys connection.
Well, remember that same cad who at the University of Michigan told me he wanted to see other women? Well, he's now my husband of 35 years. But he says he moved to Boston. So our deal was we didn't completely split up, but we could each. And, of course, I went off to CIA with all these cute young chefs. So I had a good time, too. But he missed me. I say he missed me. He said he was going to move to Boston anyway as a stepping stone to New York. And he went to Boston and started doing radio. And he wrote he was the pop music critic for the Boston Herald American. So when he writes about music. So then he dragged me to New York in 81. I loved Boston. I was a big fish in a little pond as a chef. But he dragged me to New York, and I'm glad he did, because there's many more opportunities, like you talked about, for women to do other things than work in restaurants in New York City, and I've found them. But so he moved in 81, and I don't remember what year it was, 84, 85. So he wrote for the Daily News and People Magazine and all sorts of things. He met Russell Simmons, and they really hit it off. And Russell said, this is when Def Jam just first started, Russell said, you know, you need to come work for me. I'm not sure what it is. So Bill went and worked for him for a couple of weeks and then said, I know what it is. I'm going to be your publicist. So he was the first publicist for Def Jam when they were down on Broadway. And so he worked with Run DMC and LL Cool J and the Beastie Boys and Will Smith and Public Enemy and all of those guys for 6 years and then continued on doing, you know, by himself. But that's the Beastie Boy connection. And what happened was, I'd never really met the Beastie Boys. Bill obviously knew them pretty well. But when they did the big New York album, unbeknownst to me, Adam Ad-Rock watched my show. And he loved it. So he put he called it baked Alaskan. It's like they killed a human and put him into a, you know, frozen dessert. But he put it into one of the rhymes. And I found out about that. I felt like, oh, my God, I died and went to heaven. You know, I'm in a Beastie Boys rhyme on that big album, you know, that big whatever it is it opens up. So, yeah, that's how that happened.
So Sarah Moulton has hip-hop street cred, everybody.
Wow.
You heard it here.
Well, I guess so. Very exciting. My husband had a wonderful art gallery in Chelsea called I Jammy Fine Arts. And we had, it was a hip-hop gallery. And I think we had it for about 5 years. I don't remember when we stopped, maybe 2007. But we'd have four or five openings. It was just a one-room gallery, and we'd have themes. So it'd be Run DMC, or it'd be women in hip-hop, or he did one on skateboards. And I was the snack girl, you know, and the wine person. And this is, you know, when I was still on the Food Network, when I was really pretty well known in the food world. And so, but I would just be there as his Mrs. Bill Adler, right? So I would stand behind the counter and pour, you know, whatever we had, and I made snack mix and, you know, dole it out and blah, blah, blah. I can't tell you how many people in the hip-hop community, because they came. It was really fun. Watched the Food Network.
Oh.
So I got over and over again, you know, did anybody ever tell you you look just like... So that would happen over and over again. So it was really sort of fun.
So when people say that Sarah Moulton has really taught America how to cook, they mean it.
I guess so. It crossed over. It was fun.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to go into our speed round. Coffee or tea?
Coffee. Well, I both, actually. But I prefer... If I could only have one on a desert island, it would be coffee.
What is in your refrigerator right now?
Oh, geez. Not much, because we're going away for the next couple of days. But duck breast, salmon, some vegetables. Let me see what vegetables. Baby carrots. Not much, because we're going away. So I got exactly what we needed for dinner tonight. Oh, asparagus. It's asparagus season.
How do you like your eggs?
Oh, runny. So poached, fried, yolks doing their job as sauce.
What's your favorite kitchen tool?
I guess my knife, but second would be a giant cake lifter.
A giant cake lifter?
I don't even know what a cake lifter is.
I know, doesn't that sound like a bad dream? What it is, you know, a bench scraper, a metal bench scraper, is just a giant version. And it's made to lift cakes, but I use it to lift big mounds of broccoli and chopped up Brussels sprouts and all sorts of things for transportation. Wilton makes it.
Ooh.
It's a wonderful tool.
Okay, we're going to check this out.
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing to cook?
Soup.
Where's your favorite place to eat?
If somebody else is paying, Le Bernardin.
What's your go-to snack?
Well, my naughty snack is frozen peanut M&Ms.
What are some of your favorite food magazines or blogs?
Now, that is a really interesting question. I get almost all of them. I guess Cook's Illustrated, because I'm sort of a science nerd.
Where do you want to travel to next?
France, and I am. With the husband for our 35th anniversary.
Aww,
oh, happy anniversary.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming here again.
Thank you.
Sarah's new book is Sarah Moulton's Home Cooking 101, How to Make Everything Taste Better. Make sure to check it out. Everybody should have this in their cookbook collection if they love to cook at home or just want to learn how to cook better. And Sarah, thank you for everything you've done. I mean, we talk a lot about all the people who've inspired us and who inspire all the women in the industry, and you really have inspired so many of us, so we appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
And we appreciate you coming by for the second time.
Oh, I love it. I had a great meal at Roberta's first and fabulous coffee, A+.
Well, take care, and we will be right back with Berta Gonzalez Nieves. Do you love chocolate? Turn your passion into a profession with École Chocolat School of Chocolate Arts. This award-winning school offers many programs for chocolate making so you can master techniques and gain the expertise and business knowledge you need to become a professional chocolate maker. You'll create mouth-watering chocolate recipes from professional instructors while interacting with your classmates and tutors all online. Become a chocolate expert with Ecole Chocolat via your computer, phone, or tablet. Pursue your passion for chocolate. Visit ecolechocolat.com today.
Today's episode is brought to you by Prince Street, Dean and DeLuca's monthly podcast dedicated to the delicious and infinite connections between people and food. Each new Prince Street podcast features special guests, reports, and meals from around the world. Editor-in-Chief Howie Kahn hosts the show, featuring segments from correspondents such as Griffin Dunn, Jay McInerney, Eden Grinchpan, and Sierra Tischgart. Download Prince Street on iTunes and online at livefromprincestreet.com. Prince Street, a fresh new podcast with a culinary heart.
Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. Our next guest is Berta Gonzalez Nieves, the co-founder of Casa Dragones, a 100% blue agave Joven tequila made in Tequila, Mexico. Berta is the world's first female maestra. You're going to have to pronounce that for me.
Tequilera.
Okay.
Sounds much better.
Sounds better when you say it. And she is here to not only explain to us everything about her amazing career and the tequila world, but she's also brought some of her incredible product for us to test. I didn't know you were doing this, so this is a really
yes, and it's
nice
perfect
surprise.
For Cinco de Mayo.
Well, thank you for having me today, Carrie.
Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. We've been trying to get you on the show for about a year now, haven't we?
Sorry, it's been just because going back and forth to Mexico, it gets a little bit complicated, but excited to be here on Cinco de Mayo. And what better way to celebrate than, you know, it's a little bit, it's already 1:30, so it's okay for us to cheer with Casa Dragones Joven.
Absolutely. Well, we're thrilled you finally made it here. So tell us, Gilly's going to take some pictures so people can see what we actually have in our hands. So if you follow our Twitter feed, you'll be able to see it. But just tell us about this product. What are we drinking?
So today we're drinking Casa Dragones Joven, which is the first tequila that we brought to market. It's a rare style of tequila. Joven is an overlooked style in the tequila category. Our appellation of origin recognizes white tequila, rested, aged, and extra aged. And Joven, for some reason, is an overlooked style. In this particular case, we're drinking a blend of white tequila with a five-year-old extra aged tequila. So you're going to really discover a very beautiful blend of citrus and floral notes balanced with the sweetness and the spice of the extra aged tequila.
So we're drinking this straight, no ice.
So Casa Dragones Joven was specifically designed as a sipping tequila and also to pair with food. So we're drinking it neat in Riedel Overture tequila glass, sorry for my pronunciation, and which is the official glass that we use for professional tastings in the tequila industry.
So in the Cherry Bomb family, Claudia is the tequila expert.
I am the tequila drinker, I would say, which I was never really into tequila. But, you know, everyone kept telling me it's really good for you. Doesn't give you a hangover. If you don't mix it with anything, you really can't mix it with anything like sugars or anything. But everyone was telling me how great it was and how it's an upper as opposed to like a downer. So I tested it out. I road tested it at my cousin's wedding, and I basically just drank tequila the entire night. And in the morning, I was like ready to go. No headache, nothing. You know, if I drank the same amount of whiskey, I would have been like dead. Do you find it is kind of a different effect on people?
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think if you have a night of whiskey or you have a night of vodka and then you have a night of tequila, it's very different. I think also the way you drink the spirit has a lot to do. So you were drinking it neat and hopefully having a glass of water in between
yes.
your glasses of tequila. But certainly, if it's 100% agave, the agave plant is an extraordinary plant. So you're getting really a very beautiful spirit that comes directly from Agave Azul Tequilana Weber. So there's a certain, characteristic of a night with tequila, and it's certainly used to, you know, traditionally you can say it's a happy night.
Yeah, but you can't drink cheap tequila. It has to be 100% agave, I think.
So, I mean, we, as a small producer, we are diehard 100% agave producers, and we do have all the respect for our appellation of origin and whatever is within those rules. There's also a place for mixto tequilas. In our particular case, as a small producer, that we produce in small batches, and that we're really trying to compete with other sipping spirits. We're trying to compete with cognacs, and we're trying to compete with whiskeys. So we believe that tequila has all the credentials to be able to do that, and that's why we believe in 100% agave, and we really believe in actually putting all our efforts into our production process and our craftsmanship to be able to prove that tequila should have a wider presence of the, you know, of the luxury segment of the spirits industry.
So tell us how we should be sipping this. And if you buy nice tequila and have it at home, how should you do it?
So if you buy nice tequila and you're drinking it at home, I would say that the first thing, it would be great if you are curious like you are when you're drinking wine. So if you are, just try and like read a little bit more of where the agave comes from, what's the producer's background. I would start there before you start drinking. And then when we're doing a tasting, what we do is we always start with the visual characteristics. So you take your glass and you put it against the light. And then in our particular case with Casa Dragones Joven, you're going to notice that we have a very beautiful platinum shine. And if you look at the walls of the glass, you're going to notice that Casa Dragones Joven has long and pronounced legs. It's a sipping tequila, so the way that the body embraces your palate plays a very important role. And then after you analyze the visual characteristics, then in our particular case, it's a blend of white tequila with extra aged tequila. We're a young tequila producer, and we're trying to be part of the conversation of pushing tequila production into the future. So we use ultra-modern processes. So we do the blend, and we take out the color of the extra aged tequila.
Oh, okay. I was wondering why it was so clear.
And we do that because we want your palate and your nose to define the blend. That's one characteristic of this particular product.
It's beautiful how
it's
clings.
Yeah,
it clings to the side of the glass.
Then
that's so cool.
We go to nose the product. We traditionally divide the glass into three sections, which it's difficult to do in radio, because and then it will show you the power of this glass in particular. You can really take a lot of different characteristics from the agave, from your distillation process, and from your aging just in the nose. But if you can close your eyes with me and position your nose, you know, you can circulate the glass so you can, you know, try and spend some time with the aroma. And Casa Dragones Joven has a very beautiful, open aroma. You will not get, the first thing that you get is not an alcohol kick.
No.
So what we're trying to do in the aroma is we're trying to make it very open, very fresh, very inviting. It has very beautiful floral and citrus notes. We're trying to take, you know, most of the experience of the alcohol out to really bring to the front the complexity that the plant has to offer. So I would spend some time in the aroma, and then I would taste the product. So assuming it's your first cheer of the day here for Cinco de Mayo, we traditionally, for a professional tasting, we start with a neutral grain spirit to prepare your palate, and then you do the first sip. So let's do the first sip and then the second sip so we can share with everybody.
I'm already on like my fifth sip.
This is my first sip. Ready?
It's very smooth, I have to say.
I just did that wine thing that I probably shouldn't have done where you breathe in. Is that right? Or no, you don't do that with tequila.
You don't do that with tequila. And plus, it's your first sip, so let's do that. Let's do the second sip.
Yeah, this amateur over here, tequila amateur. All right, take two. But I will say the flavors and the fragrance that kind of fill your mouth are really intense and beautiful.
So you have floral, you have like, it's a soft and smooth with the flavor with hints of vanilla and spice undertones, balanced with delicate notes of pear. There's around 600 different aromas and flavors cataloged in the tequila industry. So what we're trying to do as small producers is we're trying to deliver a very well-balanced tequila that delivers a very complex taste. So it's more about the journey of the flavor that takes you through from the aroma to the taste. And the finish is a long, warm finish that's not arresting, and it has a very long permanence in your palate that lingers for a long time, and it really is an invitation to sip. So that's why we call it a sipping tequila. It's not pushing you to have any type of chaser. Mm-hmm. You're not looking for, you know, you both have waters, I think, in front of you. And the idea is that the actual product actually sets the pace at how you should be drinking this tequila.
So does it break your heart when people use this to make margaritas?
Oh, well, you wouldn't.
if you're really posh, maybe.
Maybe if you're posh, yes.
While I'm there, it really hasn't happened.
They don't do it in front of you.
Yes. We don't recommend it. Mm-hmm. With this particular tequila, it was really designed for sipping. So we've tried to be convinced before about this, and there's no convincing.
Well, you do make a silver tequila, which is might be more palatable for cocktails.
So after 5 years of producing our Hoven, many of our, you know, of our friends and many of the gatekeepers of our industry were talking to us and saying, okay, we love sipping your tequila. Even like some of the top bartenders say, we love like finishing our night with one glass of Casa Dragones Joven, but when are you going to do something that we can actually play with? Mm-hmm. So then came our second stage. You know, we believe in producing tequilas for occasions rather than styles. And so we went again to do the due diligence on how we were going to, again, we're trying to innovate every time we come to the market with a new style of tequila, and then came our Blanco. So our Blanco tequila is, we focus in using an ultra-modern process to expose the purity of our agave. So it's a tequila that comes direct from distillation. So it's a little bit of the black belt of our industries. When it comes direct from distillation, it really is, it's the plant in your process. So you have a very beautiful, very herbaceous, very green tequila that lends itself to, you know, we're always going to make great sipping tequilas, but it really lends itself, it's beautiful on the rocks. And it also has enabled us to now have a conversation with barmen across Mexico and the U.S. The same relationship that we have with chefs, with Hoven, we're now having that conversation with barmen, which really completes the picture for us as a small producer.
So if you go to a nice bar, you should be able to ask for a Casa Dragones.
We don't have tremendous distribution, but certainly there's many bars that carry both Casa Dragones Joven and Casa Dragones Blanco.
So we could probably talk about tequila for another hour or so with you, but we need to talk about you, because you are major and you are one of the most powerful women in Mexico. I know you don't walk around telling people that when you introduce yourself, but that's super major, and we're honored to have you here. So how did you get your start in the liquor and spirits world?
I got started really out of passion. I was selected by the Japanese government to represent Mexico in a program in Japan, like a scholarship in my early 20s. And as part of my training, I had to go and learn all, you know, how to be eloquent about our economy and our industries. So I got invited to go to Tequila Jalisco for 3 days. And I remember calling my parents after the first day saying, I know what I want to do. I want to go into the tequila industry. And they're like 22, 23. They're like, this is going to be the flavor of the month. And it was not. So I really like fell in love with the whole production process and also the role that tequila plays for Mexican culture, both within Mexico and outside of Mexico. So I prepared my career. And finally, when I had, you know, somewhat of a good resume, I went and knocked on the doors of the industry. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got into the tequila industry.
And were you working for the industry in Mexico or the United States or internationally?
I started first in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And I had the opportunity to work with the eldest tequila producer in the world. So it was really, for someone that is in love with tequila, I was like, the biggest incredible thing. You know, every day I almost didn't go home at night because I was so excited to be there. And that's, you know, that's how I got started.
And you were a major marketing executive.
So I did a little bit of everything. You mm-hmm. know, I worked for them in the Mexican market and then worked globally. Mm-hmm. So I've done a lot of different things, from understanding the tequila market internationally, which is so interesting when you see people in Germany or U.S. or Canada or China, you know, what is the perception of these, of our national spirit, and then have the chance to really develop a lot of different products for the industry.
So what made you leave this big, stable job you had in the industry and start your own thing and launch an indie tequila brand?
I think after almost a decade of being there, I tried different entrepreneurial experiences on the side. I launched the Time Out kind of hybrid New York magazine in Mexico City with a group of friends and felt how that felt. And then also, so I started realizing that I had a real entrepreneurial nature and that my passion was in tequila. So I started just thinking, wouldn't it be amazing to have the chance to do your own thing? And you know, in New York, how things are. So I was right here in a party in Williamsburg, And I had the chance to meet Bob Pittman, who is a big American entrepreneur and, you know, started in radio and has been CEO of iHeartMedia. And Bob told me...
One of the founders of MTV, for those who don't know, Bob.
And we started that conversation in a party in Brooklyn, and that's how it became from a, you know, from a informal conversation to a formal conversation very quickly. And we saw the opportunity to truly bring to the category a completely different expression.
Yeah, and I feel like, I don't know, you probably had a big role in this, but the perception of tequila has really changed over the years. I remember drinking Casa Dragones in some basement of a Tribeca, I don't know, townhouse party back in like 2000, probably 9 or 10, and it was the first time I've ever heard of sipping tequila. And I feel like in the past 7 years, it's just exploded. This category has just really changed.
Well, it's so exciting. It's a very dynamic category, and agave spirits in general are in explosion. So for us as a small producer within the tequila category, it's been very exciting to see, the U.S. market as well as the Mexico market, they're the most largest tequila markets in the world. And the consumer both here and in Mexico is continuing to like love how the category is evolving. So we're definitely, you know, very proud of what we're doing in the category and very excited about what's coming in the future.
So, Berto, we're sorry we have to wrap this up, but we would love to have you come back one day and talk to us more about your amazing career and your amazing tequila brand. But thank you for coming today and sharing your beautiful product with us, Casa Dragones. Look for it in better...
On our website.
On your website. That's casadragones.com?
Yep.
Fantastic. All right. We will be right back with Mimi Sheraton. Were you into avocado toast before any of your friends? Do you know how to whip up some cashew cream? And do you make your own almond milk? If so, you're our kind of person, and you might be interested in the classes at the Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts, located in the heart of Manhattan. Founded in 1977, NGI is the first culinary school dedicated to healthy cooking to be accredited nationally. Their professional chef's training program is offered full and part-time, and several of our favorite chefs are alumni, including Dirt Candy's Amanda Cohen, Alyssa Wagner of Dimes, and Chloe Coscarelli of By Chloe. Visit the NGI website to learn how you can transform your life and your career. For over 70 years, Baldor Specialty Foods has been curating and delivering the best and freshest food in the world to the restaurant and hospitality industries. Chefs rely on Baldor for the most diverse, freshest produce and new exciting ingredients that you can't get anywhere else. Baldor streamlines the process of getting the top quality produce and specialty items right to your door. Baldor Foods is the trusted resource and partner for the industry's top professionals. Learn what Baldor can do for your business today at baldorfoods.com. We are back with Radio Cherry Bomb, and now we are going to hear from Mimi Sheraton in 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die.
This is Mimi Sheraton, Le Grand Bouffe Lamb with Pissaladier. One of the hit movies of 1973, Le Grand Bouffe featured three wealthy, handsome, and bored bachelors determined to eat themselves to death over a long weekend in a villa outside of Paris. One by one, they succeed, and the film is remembered for the stellar performances of Marcello Mastroianni, Philippe Noiret, and Hugo Tognazzi as the suicidal gourmands. But to many serious eaters, real star is the sumptuous nonstop avalanche of dishes prepared by the chef, played by Michel Piccoli. One of the most memorable meals of this found and lost weekend, and one well suited to outdoor cooking, was a garlic-infused gigot of lamb spit roasted over a wood fire, kept moist by intermittent brushings with olive oil-soaked branches of rosemary. The meat was sliced down blood rare and placed alongside slabs of golden, soothingly piquant pissolardier with its pizza-like crust topped with piquant blend of silky onion, salty anchovies, and black Niçoise olives, a perfect complement to the gentle flavor of the young lamb. The director may have failed to add a glass of Provence's chilled Roseate Bandol wine, but you should not.
Thank you, Mimi Sheraton. So that's it for today. Be sure to pick up Mimi's book, 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, at your favorite cookbook shop. And Radio Cherry Bomb would like to thank the following for supporting our show: Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts. Start your journey to become a natural food chef today by visiting ngihca.edu.
Ecole Chocolat. Check out different classes they offer at ecolechocolat.com. If chocolate is your passion, you just might want to make it your profession. And also Prince Street, a fresh podcast with a culinary heart. For more, visit livefromprincestreet.com or download Prince Street podcast from iTunes.
And Baldor Specialty Foods. They curate and deliver the best and freshest food in the world to the restaurant and hospitality industries. You can learn more at baldorfood.com.
Thank you for listening, everyone.
You're the bomb.
Hi, I'm Jackie Gable, exploring the world and sharing my adventures on Instagram at No Leftovers. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Becca Parrish, for her fearless female attitude and passion for food that's just contagious.